My next guests are masters of watchmaking based in Birmingham. They handcraft cases from gold and silver bar and sheet metal in their workshops in the Jewellery Quarter in Birmingham. They have not only restored and handmade some remarkable watches, they have also restored hundreds of years worth of watchmaking tools. Their workshop looks very cool. I definitely have workshop envy. They're constantly expanding, educating and creating inspirational movement, no pun intended, within the British watchmaking scene. They are coach builders of the watch world, in my opinion, and casting, milling, using vintage techniques to create masterpieces of time. I definitely want to buy one of their creations because I believe in their brand, their hard work and handmaking skills, and what they are trying to achieve with the watchmaking industry. Without further ado, please welcome Fellow of the British Horological Institute, the first watchmaker to earn a PhD in the UK, and the co-founder of Struthers Watchmakers, Dr. Rebecca Struthers. And he is a master watchmaker and also the co-founder of Struthers Watchmakers, Craig Struthers. Guys, how are we?
Thank you.
Thank you for having me on. Struthers, it's Struthers, but it's only a slight...
Say again.
It's Struthers. It's Struthers. I don't mind Struthers. Struthers is cool.
This is the London accent. I apologise.
I like it.
Cool. Yeah. Okay.
I was Essex at one point.
Would you? Struthers it is then. Okay. Okay. So tell us, guys, what you've been up to lately.
We've been doing a lot of making parts for our new projects, Project 248, because we can't spend as much time in our Birmingham workshop. We're in a smaller workshop at home, which is really kitted out for making rather than restoration and servicing. So we're coming in a few days a week to sort of keep our backlog of restoration going. And that's what we've been doing, kind of mixing it up and just trying to obviously be safe and not, you know, too much. But that's how it is at the moment.
Okay, okay. And where are you with 248 at the moment?
You've been writing your book.
Say again, sorry, it's breaking up, hang on. Say that again, sorry. Can you hear me?
So basically, yeah.
Yes, yeah, we can hear you.
Yeah.
So basically, I've been with the parts and everything. Rebecca's been working studiously on her book.
Yes.
And that's taken up a lot of time as well. So we're kind of split at the moment between two different big projects, whereas normally we'd be on it together in the workshop. We're having to sort of hide things down the middle. But we're 248. I mean, it's a long project, and as we've been kind of working through it, there's elements we've been changing as we go. Only slight differences.
Yeah.
But we're kind of at the Abouche stage, which I would kind of say is the basic model before a master watchmaker would refine it and set up the escapement and wheels and things like that.
Okay.
So it's kind of the bare bones. The bare bones are done. The engraving is the next stage.
Yes.
Our engraver is based in Austria. So
Germany now.
Sorry, he's based in Germany now.
Okay.
So
okay.
We've got a few issues with getting the parts of the watch to be engraved to Germany. So that's put a bit of delay on things, but
still exciting.
Yeah. Apart from that, it's still happening. I mean, it's every little sort of step that knocks us back a bit, it just means we work on something else and then the next thing as it happens, basically.
There's so much to do, isn't there?
Yeah.
It sounds very interesting. What you guys do, I've watched a few of your YouTube channels and stuff and all the talks that you give, Rebecca, and at the Horological Society, I think there was one, and there was one in New York, and it's definitely very... I don't claim to know a lot about mechanical movements in watches, but I'm very interested to find out. So talk me through the basic movements of watches, and because I know is there an English escapement, or there's a...
Yeah, so we're using an English lever escapement in Project 248 that we're making, although that hasn't really been made commercially for probably 100 years now.
Yeah,
but
it's a very basic form of the club tooth, which is the escapement you'd normally see in a modern Swiss wristwatch. It's instead of having boot style feet on the escape wheel, it's got sharp ratchet teeth.
Okay.
So in a way, it's a lot more delicate.
Yeah, the escapement is a basic mechanical watch movement, comprises of a series of components, groups of components. Okay. The escapement is at the end of the watch train that you have a wheel, a lever, and an oscillating balance that controls the release of power from the mainspring. Okay. So that's the bit that makes the tick. And if you have a look at the video of mechanical watch, it's a bit you can see vibrating really quickly. That's the balance wheel. And the escapement obviously can come in various different designs and has done for over the centuries. Since the first watch that we know about was made in at the turn of the 16th century, so in around 1500. And it's changed a lot since then.
Okay.
So that's the escapement at the end, and that runs down a gear train of wheels and pinions to the mainspring, which is the power source. So you get this tightly coiled spring in a barrel that creates the circular motion that the escapement regulates the release of.
Okay. What the springs made of? Because they have to be quite flexible, but actually stiff enough to hold for quite a long time. So what are they made of?
Traditionally, steel and steel alloys. There's various, it's a real science, spring making. So there's various different alloys. But I mean, these days, silicon is used as well to make air springs.
I think they've experimented with glass, diamond, all sorts.
Really? Okay.
I think some of it's kind of to show off, maybe, in some ways, how extreme you can take it with making a hairspring. But at the same time, there is also a scientific element to it, as in if it's not affected by temperature or synchronism errors, or I suppose in
magnetism.
Magnetism.
Big problem.
But the other side of the coin is with the older hairsprings, you could, if there was a fault with them, you could adjust them quite easily with tweezers. Mm-hmm. Whereas some of the modern materials, once they're broken, that's it. You have to make another one.
Right.
So in the future, that could be difficult for future restorers of modern watches that are being made now, is that it might not be as easy to kind of source or make a diamond hairspring, if that makes sense.
Okay. And I noticed in some of your videos, guys, you've got some really old machines, and I at the moment I've only got one old machine in the garage, and that's just an old sewing machine, and it's about 80 to 100 years old. I haven't got it started yet. I know you've got Barney the lathe, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Albert, which is, what is it, a Wolf John milling machine or something?
Yeah,
Wolf Yan.
You see, my I do speak another language, guys, believe me, but my German, French, Austrian, terrible.
I suppose a lot of the tools that we get, in fact, East Germany made some brilliant tools. So you get used to the names, and a lot of the names we use in horology are from the French as well. So our knowledge of language is directly tethered to watchmaking outside of watchmaking. So we've got a few bits of old kit, really. I think it all started out when we first set up our business.
Yeah.
And we were originally in London, but I'm from Birmingham. Mm-hmm. Craig, you grew up in Essex, didn't you? And we've got a jewellery quarter here. So we had a centre of manufacturing that we both trained here as well. We met here at uni.
Yes.
We decided to come back here because, bluntly, because it was cheaper. We could afford to do it. Our first business loan was 15,000, which compared to a brand new Swiss lathe, an 8mm watchmaker's lathe, which is like the cornerstone for manufacturing. You really, really need one of those as a basic essential.
Yeah.
To get a brand new one from Switzerland with all the kit and equipment on it is easily 30 grand now. So we start with a tiny sum of money. There was no way that wouldn't have even covered like a month or two's rent and a deposit in London. So we came back and
we spent it in a week, basically.
But with that, we could only get old stuff off eBay. Of getting boxes of bits from like shed floors and garages and things, and then rebuilding them and refurbishing them ourselves.
Yeah.
Because we couldn't afford the alternative. But in a weird way, it's kind of become such a lovely part of how we work. But even now, as we're growing and we could start to afford some newer equipment in, we never would really. They're all such character, and they're so well made.
Yeah.
As well, like equipment that's 100 years old is so much better made than a lot of the stuff being made now.
Yeah. I think the only frustration is some of the lathes have been, I mean, considering how old they are, some of them have been badly, they've not been looked after, and they've been abused. And I think that's one of the problems of buying secondhand lathes, because you need the accuracy.
Yeah.
So as we've gone on, we have been able to replace them with, well, lathes that have had a better life.
Still old ones.
Still old, but yeah, so that's the only luxury we've had. We haven't got one piece of new kit, I don't think. No, definitely not.
We're in our workshop at the moment. We're just looking around us for anything new.
Yeah.
I mean, they all look clean and nice now.
Timing machine.
We kind of get used to it. You get used to the idiosyncrasies of each tool and what its pros and cons are, and you kind of work around it. Yeah. We're not making sort of, you know, future sports watches or anything.
Yeah. We're not making hundreds of them.
Yeah. So we can work slowly and work around any issues with any tool, and work our own way of keeping the accuracy there and things.
Yeah. So how do you ensure that it's so what's the accuracy of the lathe, for example? What plus or minus, how many?
It should be hundreds of a millimetre.
Yeah, we have to work to within hundreds of a millimetre for the finest parts of watches. So how we make sure that's accurate, a lot of it is using really old school methods that probably haven't changed an awful lot. So going by eye and being able to spot that something's running true.
Yeah.
Wobble sticks, we use things like that too.
Yeah.
You were talking earlier about making jigs.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I probably go about, well, me and Rebecca are quite different in the way we work, but in a good way. So being quite dyslexic, I mean, when it comes to maths and science, I literally, if I'm honest, I don't really have any interest or want to understand it. It sounds ridiculous for a watchmaker, but I make a jig, so I'll find something that resembles what I want to make. I'll file it, drill it, get it to size, and once it's working, then I'll make a jig that fits that piece, and then I'll use that to make the other parts.
Yeah.
And it's a long-winded way of doing it, but that's how I did it. Because when we were at uni, we used to get handed sheets on, this is what you've got to make for your next project.
Yes.
And it was basically a technical drawing with loads of measurements, and straight away, because the way I work, I used to look at that and just think, that means nothing to me, I'm stuck.
Yeah.
So I'd get rid of that, and then I'd find the part, or the part that we were supposed to make, and then I'd go backwards from that.
Okay.
I do draw. I mean, I draw for my own.
I've seen those, yes. I've seen those. You're a very good drawer, by the way.
Thank you. It's very kind of you. Some of it's quite juvenile, but it for me, it works. I don't really do technical drawings. We don't use CAD, so it's just my way of... I've got a book of 248, which I started when we first started making the parts.
Yes.
And Rebecca was putting in all the... what they call with the mindstorm things?
Brainstorming.
Yeah.
So Rebecca did the practical side and showed me this is the way we need to... the route we're taking.
Yes.
And as I'd make the parts, I'd draw it, but I do... shading and unnecessary things to the little picture,
which
are quite, but just because that's, you know, to me that made it more enjoyable, which is strange.
So is the book about 248 then? Is the book about the watch?
Workshop. It's just a workshop. It's a random collection of notes and sketches and mistakes and problems and ramblings.
Yes,
just have got me through this project.
A lot of loose bits of paper. I keep telling you to stick them before you lose them.
Yeah. So when's the book released, guys? When's the book released?
So the 248 book is just for us. That's just a bench book. My books that I'm writing at the moment will be out in spring 2022. So a year away now. I'm just finishing writing.
Okay. But this other book, the 248, the clippings and things, that would be a great book, surely, for us to. I mean, I would have that as a coffee table book, you know.
I don't know, you haven't seen it. It's pretty rough. I mean, it would have to be a coffee table book because there's quite a lot of coffee rings in it.
Yeah.
That's all right. Yeah.
I don't know, maybe I could refine it and turn it into some sort of little illustration book of our little way that we made our watch. It might be interesting. Some people have looked at it, some clients, and they seem to really like it. But I don't know whether they're humouring me sometimes, but it helps me make it anyway. That's the main point.
Yeah. So going back to the tools, the old tools, did you restore them yourself? And how did you go about doing that? Because obviously you're not a tooling expert, you're a watchmaker.
But it's still a really important part of watchmaking. Like the course that we did when we first started training, the first projects that we did were making some hand tools.
Yeah.
So being able to have your own hand tools to make watches with is, like it used to be apprentices used to have to make their own toolkit before they're allowed to go anywhere near a watch. Learning and with tools, I mean, it's still engineering, it's still mechanics. Yeah. So if you're used to working with mechanics, you kind of know how they go. There are some bits we can't do.
It's a good point. Yeah, you have raised a good point. I mean, obviously, there's the basics of stripping them down and getting rid of the old dried oils and grease and stuff is pretty basic. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the bearings, you know, we don't have the type of machines to make things of that size. So that's when we've outsourced to small engineering companies who could supply hardened bearings or
But you've designed tools as well, so both Helga and Spitzmaus.
We've designed tools to adapt what a tool is to do something else.
Yeah, I love the fact that you've got names for all the tools, by the way. That's brilliant.
Yeah, otherwise we'd never know which tools we were talking about. It kind of narrows them down quite
a bit. It's an effective way,
But yeah, we found like a local engineering company. So I'd do a rough sketch and then take it to them, tell them what I'm trying to do. Sometimes the pre-COVID, obviously, come to the workshop and I'd show them what I'm trying to make this tool do.
Yeah.
And then sometimes they'd bring something to the table as well, being engineers.
Yes.
They'd probably do like this. And then they'd go away and they'd make this block or part. And then I'd attach it to our lathe and it's automatically doing something else it couldn't do before.
Yeah.
Which to me is brilliant because we've involved someone else in it. Yeah. They're also interested in what we're doing.
Yeah.
It just adds to it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You get very lonely as a watchmaker doing it all yourself.
Definitely.
I've seen some of the old pictures of the old watchmakers and they just look like they're in a... I know a few guys in Hatton Garden who are diamond dealers and they've got these little studios that are probably half the size of this room that I'm in here. And they're just stuck in a little bench on a little corner by themselves for days. And you can see that psychologically they've been affected by working on their own for that long.
It does do things to you. Yeah. You're in like the things you're working on as well. So if you've got like a major restoration, you might have a movement that's maybe a couple of centimetres across at the most.
Yeah.
And in that there's what, 70 to 100 parts, even in a basic one. And in a big restoration, you can be working on that for days, even weeks.
Yeah.
And you're just tiny, like you work on a sheet of A4 paper and everything is going on in that little zone and you're working through magnification as well. So everything around you kind of gets lost. And like people ask us what it's like working together as a married couple.
Yeah.
But in reality, we can go whole days without
very little conversation.
To each other. Yeah, you're just on the zone.
Yeah, yeah.
It's nice to get out and meet other people. Sometimes it's too weird.
Yeah.
You make a good team, though. You make a good team. I remember thinking that when I first met you, actually.
Thank you. We get on. After all these years, we're still talking.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier about different ways we approach projects, and I think that's what makes it work, because otherwise we'd probably argue.
Yeah, we have opposite skill sets, so we're never trying to do the same thing at the same time.
Yeah.
No, Rebecca's, although we don't use CAD or anything, I used to be in IT, but I'm useless with computers. Yeah. So if we have to draw up a dial, Rebecca's very good at that. And anything to do with sort of maths and Illustrator, which is really only dials, I think. I don't think we use it for much else.
No, it's the only bit that we can't do in any other way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it's obviously so
precise
and... You need to be able to do extremely precise artwork for a dial to get it printed.
Okay, so you don't use CAD. So how do you make sure that, this is one of my questions to you actually, how do you make sure that everything fits together? and works
doing accurately. It's based upon I think originally the feel for doing it and the knowledge and the way of practicing it was through restoring old watches that were missing parts.
Okay.
So, I mean, some of the things we've worked on, 1920s ladies' cocktail watches, missing like a center wheel and a balance.
Yes.
And I mean, for most, they've probably gone around a lot of watchmakers who it's not an economically viable repair.
Yeah.
So I used to agree to do it and regret it afterwards, but you basically spend hours sort of working out. First of all, like the size of the balance staff, because that's missing, and then the size of the balance, hairspring, center wheel, and then once you've kind of got everything the right size, without having any reference, it's sometimes by looking at other movements of a similar size. When you've worked on so many, you get a general idea, because there's also an element of a lot of movements do use similar size parts.
Yeah.
There's a lot of... what's the word, badge engineering involved in some of the watch industry, even going back 50 to 100 years.
Yeah.
So from that experience, you then begin to work out how you can plant wheels in a train, the distance between each jewel, and size of the balance, where the hairspring sits. And from that, it kind of grows into, well, I want to make a watch plate. Start with a basic bit of metal.
Yep.
Then you start planting the center wheel, and then you move out to the third, fourth, and the skate wheel. And, yeah, based on your knowledge of different calibers and sizes, you know where they're going to sit. And there are tools that you can use in watchmaking that actually have two little...
depthing tools.
It's called a depthing tool, yeah, but it has, like, sort of two needle points that can be moved in and out.
Yep.
And you can actually sit two wheels in the tool, move them together until they work together.
Okay.
Sort of
the teeth.
Yeah, so the teeth aren't binding or they're not too far apart.
Yeah.
And then that tool you can also use to mark on your plate how far apart the wheel.
Yeah, restoration is such a great way to get into making watches for that very reason, because you have to make so much for other people, so it kind of teaches you to make it for yourself. And there are quite a few independent watchmakers who started out in restoration and jewelers as well. Mm. I think generally it's a good way to get into it. She just sees so much.
CAD is brilliant. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's a lot of the, I see some of the newer, more younger maybe, and more dynamic watchmakers in that respect.
We sound so old.
Well, it's the new thing, isn't it? If I was that age, I probably would be straight onto CAD. I don't know. It's it's a fantastic tool, and
it's a lot more cost effective than physically making stuff to trial it.
Economically viable.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we use CAD to design the spacecraft or the jigs that we are putting on the spacecraft. And nine times out of ten, it works. It all goes together nicely. So it's definitely a strong tool in our kit that we use that saves time. And saves money. But I actually like the fact that you guys are craftspeople, really. You're both really skilled with your hands and your brains, and I love that. I don't know whether you watch TV, but if you watch like The Repair Shop, for example, that all those arts in that repair shop are slowly, they're dying out. Is the dog all right? my next question is, so I love mechanical movements and I love old watches. I haven't started collecting, although I do have a Longines watch, but I do like the older generation. This is like 20 year old watch, but I like the early 18th 19th century kind of Victorian Georgian watches. I'm going to say I'll go to a flea market in Europe, for example. What should I be looking out for? Is there something a non-watch expert should be looking out for so that I don't get ripped off and buy a fake?
It's really, really hard.
It's a good question.
Because we worked in auction, didn't we, for a while before we set up our own thing.
Yeah.
And fakes are so good now. I think especially if you're looking for anything quite new, it's incredible. It's scary how good they are. And it's very easy to get caught out. I think the only advice I could give someone looking for something who isn't already an expert, and even people who are experts get caught out sometimes, is don't spend more than you could afford to if you find out that it's not right.
Yeah.
I always assume it's not right, but if you really love it anyway and it is right too, that's a bonus. I think that's the best advice I can give, because
I think if
so much that's not...
There's a lot of... I mean, maybe with pocket watches, the problems you're going to have with...
it's more damage. Yeah, it's damage. Not often you see faked pocket watches unless they are... So that's like your earlier Victorian and Georgian, unless they're kind of one of the famous names like Breguet or someone like that.
Yeah.
It's more likely that they've been damaged probably over the years, and it might cost you a lot of money to have them restored if you wanted them running again. So more than just like a museum piece. I have several museum pieces. It doesn't bother me. They don't run, but they're beautiful. Whereas with the modern stuff, as soon as you get into the big brands like Longines, but also like Rolex, Cartier, Omega, there's so many wrong ones out there.
I think if you could find a... The best thing to do probably is find someone that's... I mean, this is not that easy either. A good vintage retailer who will give you 100% sort of guarantee if there's any problems, and maybe a recommendation from someone else that you've heard. If there's any issues, you can give the watch back. And normally, if they are good, there aren't any issues because it's thoroughly checked out in the first place.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we...
Or auction. If you go to a good auction house with a specialist watch department, they will have done a lot of checks. So there will always be things that slip the net, even at the top kind of dealers and everything, you hear the occasional stories. But if you go to somewhere that's reputable, you're really minimising any risk there is for you. And as for looking for stuff in flea markets, we do that, and we don't usually look for names. That's the other side of it. You just look for the weird and wonderful cool stuff that you've never seen anything like that before.
Yeah.
And the odds of that not being right are next to none, because no one's ever seen one before.
I think when I was at uni, going to the flea markets and watch fairs and finding a biscuit tin full of old junk, watch related, I'd find magical. And I still do now, to be honest. People still joke to me saying, I just found some old rubbish Craigle like that.
Yeah.
It's a really bad sort of old watches. But occasionally there's something in there that can inspire you. It doesn't have to be, you know, Patek or anything like that.
It can be old mechanical digital watches.
I used to love the Jumpower and the sort of original Deco Jumpower watches. And then some of the 70s digital mechanical watches and LED stuff. It's all interesting and has a point in history, doesn't it?
I mean, I've often found old tools that I don't know what they're used for sometimes, and I'm an engineer, so I should know, but I find tools from different trades and I think, what is this used for? Like, it's so rusty and I give it a rub down and give it a paint, and I'll put it on in my workshop downstairs and just leave it, and someone will come and say, what is that? And I still haven't found out what it's used for. But I've got old depth gauges and micrometers and vernier scales from the Victorian times, which I don't really use. I just leave them in the drawer at the moment. But I do like the older stuff and the older... I would love to find an old box of watches, just pieces, but I wouldn't know what to do with them. So I'll probably just go, here, guys, make me a watch out of this.
Yeah, you got me excited now.
Yeah, no, because it's good, yeah.
Yeah, the tool thing is true as well. The old Moore and Wright toolboxes, I don't know, the wooden ones with the little drawers.
Yeah.
And then the front folds down and slides underneath.
Yeah.
I mean, the attention to detail that used to go into things like that is... it's missing a lot now, I suppose, in some ways.
Yeah, everything that's made new now is kind of made 5-10 years' time, it'll break. Whereas you know that when you buy an old, a tool that's probably 60 years plus older, you know it's going to last a long, long time. So when you go for materials, and where do you get all your materials from? Have you got your suppliers that give you materials? Because I know that, for example, at Airbus in Stevenage, they've got a quartz growing facility, quartz crystal growth facility there.
Yeah.
And I think we supply, don't quote me on it, but I think we supply a lot of the watchmakers in the world, their quartz. So quartz, for example, where would you get that?
We don't use quartz.
Yeah, quartz is for battery-powered watches. So we only do mechanically-powered watches. Sapphire crystal.
Yes.
Something that is grown. We only use synthetic. So when you see jewels listed on a watch dial, those have got 21 jewels in it. That's synthetic corundum, synthetic ruby or sapphire.
Okay.
So things like that, it's really specialist art, of growing crystals and things. So we source them from people who do that for us. And then we either get them finished to size, or you can cut them and grind them and things yourself. Metals as well, we get a lot. Obviously, metals, there's a lot of metal in watches.
Yeah.
We've got local places that we use. Our workshop's still in the jewellery quarter. So we've got kind of our base metal dealer down the road for ferrous stuff. Mm-hmm. We've got bullion dealers locally as well that we get the gold for our cases from, our sheet that we work with. Crystals, we generally get them finished, don't we? Sapphire is so hard to cut. You need quite a lot of specialist equipment to do that. It's not really viable for us to get a full.
Yeah, I mean, mostly it's just steel and German silver, or nickel silver.
And brass.
Okay.
And brass. Yeah, a lot of brass. So very basic stuff, really, and for the main movement. That's kind of it's quite easy to get at the moment. I mean, I hope it doesn't change, but it's have a local. It's very old school. It's traditional.
It's like going back in time.
Yeah, it's like a Victorian building that's just wrapped up in metals on the shelf, and there's an old set of scales on the counter.
Yeah, they do it all in scales. Health and safety is one of the people,
So say you're going to cut a piece of metal, you want to cut it down to size, and you want to start shaping it to the, I don't know, you're going to make a wheel or something. How do you make sure you don't make a mistake? Because obviously, I mean, now you're an expert. The pair of you can probably do it with your eyes closed. But when you first started, did you ever make mistakes, and how did you rectify?
Made a lot of mistakes in so many different ways. So we started with, the basic way of doing stuff when you don't have much of a budget, as in broke watchmakers making watch parts, is Rebecca's jewellery background meant that she's very good with the piercing saw. Mm-hmm. So I used to give Rebecca everything to saw out. And it's very tedious, and especially for Rebecca. Took forever.
It's all right, it's and good arm workout,
yeah. And then she'd give it to me, and if I put it in the lathe and turned it to size, or was filing it to size, and I made the mistake, then obviously it's...
I can blame you then.
Yeah, Rebecca's done all the hard work, and then I've ruined it.
Key one, have someone else to work with that you can blame.
I think one of the best things we've discovered was wire erosion.
Yeah.
So when we're doing prototype and things like that, we still grab a bit of metal, turn it, drill it, try and get an idea of what you want. And then once we've got it, then you can kind of think, well, if I'm making like three of these, I don't want to be sawing out the shape every time for accuracy. So the little engineering company we used to make our jigs and stuff, they basically said, why don't you get that wire eroded? So wire erosion that they've got it's old technology. I think it's it started in the 50s, was it?
Yeah.
And now I think their machines are about 1990s. So they're still quite old, or very old to some people. And all it does basically is cut out a shape.
2D
shape. So you can't do any milling or anything like that. So if you want a circle, instead of sitting down and sawing that out, you can get it wire eroded. And we normally get it wire eroded slightly oversized.
Mm-hmm.
but then we can put it back in our machines and we can make sure to turn it so it's perfectly true.
Yeah.
But yeah, that, I mean, that saves a bit of time, but it's just a useful tool. So I think most of the time it saves Rebecca's arm.
Yeah.
But there's still lots of piercing. I mean, even if you get something wire eroded, you're guaranteed you're still going to have to use the piercing saw on it or the milling machine. Or it just gets you into like a little bit of a head start into certain bits.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, okay. It's interesting because I don't know whether you guys knew this. You know when we met at the Saatchi Gallery at the Salon QP all those years ago.
Yeah.
I nearly put a deposit down on one of your watches that day. And I don't know whether you guys were aware of this, but what happened was I really liked you guys and I liked the brand. I liked the feel of what you were talking about and the whole handmade stuff. And I had a few more drinks and I said to the guy, one of the guys that were with me, I said, I'm going to buy one of these watches. I think they're fantastic. And he went, just hold back and think about it. Don't just randomly just go and say, I want this watch, I'm going to buy it. And I said, no, it's only 1,500 quid, like that. And I think I was talking with you, Rebecca, and I think there's another zero or two on top of that. But I didn't realise it at the time. And I was trying to fight with my friend. He was pushing me away. And I don't know whether you clocked onto it, but he was pushing me away and I was trying to get to you to try and give you a deposit or, you know, sign some paperwork or do something. It was hilarious. But I didn't know whether you knew about that.
No, I'm flattered that you liked us. And secondly, me and Rebecca, whether you kind of were in the, you had the, obviously the cash, whatever the price was, we are the worst salespeople in the world.
Oh, yeah, we're all.
So we wouldn't have noticed if you'd literally paid for it and left of it.
Oh, okay, I'd like to put a deposit on one of your watches. We're like, really?
Yeah, I think we've grown to really appreciate and love low numbers. And if anything, I know it sounds a terrible thing to say, but we probably want to keep it like that. And if anything, make less at a slower pace and just create more ideas within the pieces. So, yeah, I think, you learn. As time goes on, depending on who you are and what you're making and what your goals are, some people obviously want to grow. Some people try to grow, then realise it's not for them. Some people... literally realise that making a few things, you know, a few bespoke clients suits their needs. And I think that's what we've worked out over this past
Using all these old machines and doing things the weird and wonderful way we do means that watches take us at the very fastest, pre-COVID obviously, maybe 8 to 8 months to a year. Mm-hmm. Some watches can take us 3 years, 4 years. So it is a really time-consuming process. So... yeah, that's kind of why it ends up being as much as it does. But at the same time, we love watches too, and we can't afford the watches we make. So we just play with vintage stuff. That's our kind of remit, and that's where finding weird and wonderful stuff in tins really comes in for us. Because we go to flea markets and we pick up stuff for like 10 quid or whatever and do it up.
not ashamed of it.
You go to these events as well and everyone will be there in like their Rolex and their Patek and stuff, and you'll be wearing some weird 1930s thing you found in a tin of family circle.
Yes.
And, for a fiver. And people come up and go, oh, that's really cool, what's that? And you're like, well, forget these big brands.
Do you know... do you know a guy called Paul Maudsley?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's a good friend of one of my best friends, and they worked in, I think they were at Bonhams years ago, but he started his own company now, but he used to work for Philips. That was the last time I saw him, I think. Say again.
Who's your best friend?
Desmond Omoa.
Bonhams. That's how I know Paul.
Oh, you used to work for Bonhams.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So he was in the Bond Street. Is it a Bond Street one? Yeah. So he was there. He was there for years. And what's the watch lady? There was a watch lady there.
Kate Lacey.
What's her name?
Kate Lacey.
That's it.
Yeah, she's at Sotheby's now.
Yeah. So I was talking with Paul anyway, and Paul said to me that he went to a flea market in Germany or Austria, one of those, and he picked up a watch, which I think was a Rolex or one of those brands. And he must have paid about, I think he said he paid about 80 quid for it, or 90 quid, something around that. And then I think he sold it at Bonhams in the auction for like thousands. And I remember thinking to myself, how can I do that? How can I? Because everyone likes to make money, but also I would love to find an old watch and buy it for a couple of, you know, a couple hundred quid. And
I'll tell you what, only fools and horses level.
Well, you know,
Harrison's
monitor. Yeah. But when I was actually at uni, when Rebecca was there as well, I bought, actually, it was off eBay, just a random tin of junk.
Yeah.
And it was on eBay, it just had loads of watches piled up in it. And not as exciting as that story, it's not as much money involved. But it was, I think I paid £50. I went to collect it off the guy. He was a clockmaker. Mm-hmm. And he bought a load of stuff in for clockmaking, and there was this tin of watch bits. And he said, I'm just not interested in that. Yeah. So I took it home, and we're going through. Actually, it was my ex-wife that pulled out this watch, and she said, it's got Oyster on the dial. And I was like, okay. She goes, isn't that something to do with Rolex?
Yeah.
And it basically was just, it's called an Oyster Junior, and it's a small...
they call them boys' watches.
They call them boys' watches, but it's basically just a small part of the Rolex, beginning of the Rolex brand back in the 40s, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And it was, an Oyster Junior. I don't know if you've ever seen one. They're quite small. But, a Rolex case, basically, with a, I think it's an FHF movement. But, that was obviously worth a lot more. I mean, they weren't that collectible then, but I think they're a bit more now, aren't they? Mm. But probably only about two and a half.
So all the pieces of that watch inside the box?
Yeah, it's actually complete. The whole, it didn't have a strap on it, and it wasn't running. But it, to the average person who looked at it, because it didn't have Rolex on the dial.
People know what they're looking for more and more now, which is kind of, it makes it harder to find sleepers, we call them, because they're more likely to be spotted, and it means that they're more likely to get copied as well.
Yes.
It is like the eBay generation. Now everyone's get that flea markets and stuff too. People just go on eBay and Google whatever they've got or whatever and find out how much they're worth. It's a lot harder now than it used to be.
Okay. So where do you see British watchmaking going over the next 100 years?
I think watchmaking generally is hitting a really interesting point now. So you've got the kind of big brands are going off doing their thing, but they're also getting a lot of competition. Mm. And you've kind of got like the trade centres, I think, are changing a little bit at the moment. So you've got Switzerland is the recent historic centre of watchmaking.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much going on in the Far East now, and Japan's doing some amazing stuff too. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops. But then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got a real rise in independent watchmaking. And that's in the UK, in Switzerland, in the US, in Japan as well, which is, really interesting. It's almost like it's polarizing more and more between the massive companies and then these tiny little people doing stuff.
Yeah, I think of independent watchmaking more than I do probably British watchmaking, because I don't know, I just think as an independent, the struggle to keep going and to be sort of... have a goal and stick to it and not be sort of quashed in any way and
keep.
And obviously you do need to find clients, even if you only want to make a few. I mean, unless you're making them for yourself as a hobby, it's a client's what you need to, because it's not just a price on a watch. For us, it's the cost of spending that amount of time over a long period of 2 to 4 years is being able to afford to do that. You obviously need to sell the timepiece, and that's where the problem is.
I feel like collectors are getting to the point, for those people who are lucky enough to be in a position to invest in that level of watchmaking, that we quite often find they've already got to the point they've bought a few of the big names, And because of the internet now, which is a wonderful thing, things like Instagram as well, really useful tools. Yeah. And doing more research around watches and watchmaking, it kind of piques that interest of the independence, because this is the point you actually get to go to a watch company and meet your watchmaker, which if you go to one of the big brands, you will never meet the person making a watch, probably because it was made largely by a machine and assembled by a team of people. Whereas if you go to one of the independents, you are meeting the person, you're shaking the hand of the person who's making your watch. Mm. And I think that means more to people.
Yeah, I think it's what someone said a while ago about the name on the dial. So for me and Rebecca, our names are on the dial. We're actually the people that made it. And it, as you kind of, I suppose in a weird way, we are craftspeople more than a brand maybe as well. Mm-hmm. But I think sometimes the brand name has got further and further away from the actual watch. It's because there's so much advertising involved now and ambassadors. And it kind of seems, sometimes it seems to have got lost in the whole media and technology rather than what the, if you go back 50 years. But I suppose in some ways it's easy for me to say that for brands to survive now, they have to do that, don't they? Yeah. They've got to be heard and be louder than the other one. So I can't really knock it. It's the way it's become, I suppose.
Yeah. So what's your favourite watch brand? Old watch brand.
Old watch brand.
And why?
We have like our favourite eras, don't we?
Yeah, so I
like
think
1920s and 30s, brands like Cartier and Tiffany were just doing some amazing, like the original Art Deco stuff. It's really, really beautiful.
Yeah, I think I think it's more of an era, sort of. I have this kind of 100-year era, 1850 to 1950 is a favourite era, just because of when I look at the watches then, you can see that the people and machines in them that have made them. There's less technology than that. I'm not anti-technology, it's just
no.
Me looking at things like that, I like to see almost a bit of, you know, they're not perfect at all, and they do have faults, and sometimes they can be a little bit crude. I don't know.
Yeah, it's like the human-machine balance is what we really like to see.
Yeah.
Watchmaking, what we try and do ourselves watchmaking now, it's that point in history where we were using machines and machines were helping us with our jobs, but those machines still needed us to help them too. So it's a very beautiful relationship. So you've got machine made, hand finished, hand assembled stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas now it's just gone down the route of, so you can get machines that make pretty much a complete watch and case and leave very little else to be done, don't they?
Yeah, I think there's definitely some early Patek and Rolexes that are obviously, I think it's the sort of romance and the history of those brands at the beginning that you kind of easily fall in love with, and the styles.
The old American stuff too.
The old American watches.
Pocket watches, and they made some beautiful
Hamilton.
Beautiful.
But I suppose in a weird way, we're kind of biased to looking backwards. If that's
Like even the new brands we like tend to be the brands that either have been around for a long time or are using very traditional techniques to this day.
Yeah.
Even when it's at a much larger scale than us. So like new brands are currently going, Maurits Grossman.
Yeah.
Makes some amazing stuff.
Frodsham made a really cool looking wristwatch recently, but they're an older brand.
Okay.
So it's
Langenhain, Langenson.
That was my next question to you. Who out of the new watch brands, who'd you like and why?
Maurits Grossman, I think.
They're one of our favourites, aren't they? I think just their style, again, the balance between machine making and hand finishing is just so good. And
The hand wound movement has a very European look to it, as in I can see elements of everything, sort of American, British and Swiss all combined to make one really beautiful looking piece. So I think that's what attracts me to the watch, rather maybe than the dial and the hands and case. It's probably more about the movement, but definitely they're on the radar. Really like
okay. So if you could bring back a forgotten or a bankrupt watch brand, which one would you resurrect and why?
There was one that there's a company called Nashua. I don't know the full history of it, but they were pre-Waltham.
Okay.
It's one of the earlier US company. High quality, high end pocket watch. I can't remember the link with Waltham, but it didn't succeed. I think it was just probably not an economically viable movement at the time, and obviously didn't last. But I think there's a few around, not many, they're very rare. It's Nashua Watch Company.
Okay.
That's one to look out for at flea market.
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly what I'm thinking, actually.
Okay. I can't think of any of this. It's probably, if I actually sat down and thought about it, there's probably quite a few. But I mean, there's so many that when you look at the vintage watches that aren't your well-known brands, there's so many that have been and gone. And some unique designs out there that probably could have stood the test of time today.
I quickly Googled Turkish watchmakers the other day, just to see if, I mean, it's a massive country. It's got lots of history. Did one come up? Nope. Do you know of any?
We know watches that are made for the market.
Made for the Turkish market was a big thing. So Markwick Markham was a pocket watch manufacturer, a maker in Georgian, London, and used to export, specialised in exporting for the Turkish market, and you get the Turkish models and stuff. But I think I don't understand this either. So we serviced a Damas Persian watch recently that had the Persian calendar, and it was a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Yeah.
But again, it tends to be things that have been imported and retailed from the Middle East, Near East, as opposed to made there. And I don't know why. I don't know if it's still part of the whole luxury, like, now we see Swiss-made watches as being the best watches, so we all want a Swiss watch.
Yeah.
Whether it's the same sort of a thing where, like, back then it was London-made watches, and now it's Swiss.
Yeah.
But maybe, you know, maybe one day the whole world market central moves there. It's changed times already. So.
Yeah, of course. So do you guys have a bucket list of things you want to achieve in the watchmaking industry then?
Finish 248.
Yeah, 248. Like that's definitely my bucket.
Yeah. This year now. So.
I think that's a major goal for us. And I think the second edition and the third edition, as it moves on, is just extending that bucket, putting it further away all the time. But that's it really. We don't want to be huge, or I think we just want to be comfortable being able to make what you want to make comfortably and have enough clients to sort of
nice clients.
Keep it, what's the word?
Keep us afloat,
That'd be brilliant. To achieve that for me would be amazing.
Okay. All right.
So that's cool.
Okay, guys. Interesting. So tell people where to find you on social media.
So we have our company, Struthers Watchmakers. We're on Instagram. We don't do much on Twitter, but our website is another good place to look, strutherswatchmakers.co.uk.
Okay.
I'm also on Instagram and Twitter as either Rebecca Struthers or Dr. Struthers, the watch doctor.
I think I follow you, yeah.
Yes, you do.
Yes.
You're very welcome to get in touch with us over social media too. We try to get in touch with everyone and reply to everyone.
Yeah.
Even with weird and wonderful things, like I do get sent a lot of photos from people saying, "What is this watch worth anything? How much should it cost? Have you got any books?" I get asked for a lot of book recommendations too. We love talking about watches. So
I stay away from the computer and I don't get asked anything. So
no, I'm
okay. Okay. Well, look, guys, thanks for being guests, and it's been great talking to you. May I wish you every success. Looking forward to meeting you again.
You're saying about classic car and things like that. Obviously, we're looking forward to things calming down a bit. And
We go to the VSCC a lot. I don't know if you go to many of their hill climbs and races.
Prescott do, the one we go to the most is Prescott Hill Climb. I don't know if you ever, things like that, we might bump into each other or...
I haven't been yet. It's on my list.
Yeah, it's cool. You enjoy it. It's really nice, small. I mean, it's not just early sort of pre-war cars. They do a special 60s event, don't they? With like 60s sports cars and bikes.
Again, beautiful cars. And again, from that era of relationship between people and machines, where cars need to be driven rather than driving us. There's a lot of overlap.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
Good look at the space crafts. I mean, that's definitely the future.
At least no one's lives are depending on our watches. That's
yours is a bit more serious.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there is people wearing watches in space at the moment.
Yeah.
So possibly.
I might have some questions about that for you. There you go. Right.
Yeah. Okay.
My book. I'm very interested.
Definitely. Just ask me anything you want, and if I don't know the answer, I will know people within my industry that will know the answer. Well, guys, thanks very much, and hopefully in the future we'll see more Struthers watches, and we'll see more of you guys, and we'll meet up and hopefully have a beer or two and discuss more about watches. Okay, but it's been an absolute pleasure, honestly. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Thank you, guys. You take care. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.